Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my compatriot, Spencer.
Nope, time's up. Hey, I'm here.
I'm like trying to find something from the movie that we saw, and I'm like, I can't really think of a because it was just so focused on her, and I'm like, I'm not going to give him a female... You know, nickname.
Oh, so we found the line of what you won't do today. That's
no,
interesting.
Whatever. Speaking of females, we are not alone as we have brought in the illustrious intern, the wonderful Miss IJNU Robot, Amy LaBelle from the Cakeless Crusaders.
I am female. Whee!
Hear her roar.
Mini roars.
We got a great show in store for you as we're going to be going over the film that actually kind of slept under, like, kind of went under the radar for most of us, and we finally got a chance to see it, and that is Millennium Actress. So stick around as we talk about that, but before we do, Spencer.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite stream platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We got over 200 episodes on our website. Check it out. This is actually a really momentous episode because we are actually recording for the very first time in Spencer and I's new apartment.
Yeah.
So we are recording live together in the midst of everything, seeing as for the last few months, we've been recording remotely online. Spencer would record his stuff. I would record mine. Then we combine it. But it's like now we're all in the same room.
Let me tell you something. The Zoom lag was real and it was bad sometimes. So sometimes if during the last few months, it seems like I was just ignoring what Eddie said. I was. I could not hear him.
That's usually the case.
It's not really.
It's one of those things where it's like you don't realize how much you appreciate recording in live time.
Yep.
Like, you gotta have the most highest speed internet to make sure there's no lag whatsoever. But we are now here within the home. This is, what would this be, like Studio A now? Or... because we had the studio over at VGB Studios,
right?
And then we had the studio when we would record at your place. So now, what is this like?
Monocle Manor.
Oh my gosh!
I don't know.
Sounds like it's part of Umbrella Academy,
right?
It does.
Or it's like a Disneyland ride. You're like, yeah. Would you like to go to Monocle Manor?
That was the worst.
I'm having a weird day.
I don't even know. That was like the Monopoly Man, like. The
Monopoly
B version,
the B version
of the Monopoly Man. That's like the,
what it's Uncle Penny something. I can't remember, but yeah, he has a voice when he talks about the new stuff.
The new stuff
was Uncle Pennybags.
Is it Money Bags?
Pennybags.
It's not Pennywise.
It's not
Penny's Worth.
Both of you guys are jumping down a rabbit trail. That's really gonna.
There's money involved in this one.
Speaking of stories, we want to talk about. We want to review a film that actually
ham-fisted.
Well, I mean you.
We're just excited to be in person.
We are excited.
So excited.
And we're also excited to talk about this movie that we just recently saw, Satoshi Kon's Millennium Actress. This movie was completely not even on any of our radars until it started coming. Well, Spencer's giving me that evil eye look.
What the heck are you talking about?
It wasn't on my radar because the only reason why I was aware of it were those like Fathom event things that were happening at the theaters. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh. Well, that looks cool. And then you see the trailer. Like, oh, my gosh. It's so, you know, there looks like it's a lot of story to dive into. And then you find out it's Satoshi Kon's. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. The guy who did Paprika and Tokyo Godfathers, which I still haven't seen yet. But forget you both.
But you haven't seen it. And it's like the one that brought me in to begin with. I still haven't seen Paprika, which is bad. But
and I've seen Paprika. So.
So trade these.
So take that. We finally got a chance to see this movie and... Let me just say, I am excited to talk about this movie. It was very beautiful, very unique, and I'm getting ahead of myself. So before I do, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Oh gosh, I didn't learn how to say this. When the legendary G9 Studios shuts down, filmmaker Genya Tachibana and his assistant are tasked with interviewing its reclusive star, Chiyoko Fujiwara, who had retired from the spotlight 30 years prior. And she recounts her career. Genya and his crew are literally pulled into her memories, where they witness her chance encounter with a mysterious man on the run from the police. Despite never knowing his name or face, Chiyoko relentlessly pursues that man in a seamless blend of reality and memory that only Satoshi Kon could deliver.
Exactly. Written and directed actually by the renowned anime filmmaker Satoshi Kon, the film stars Miyoko Suiji, Mami Koyama, Fumiko Onikasa, Shozo Izuka, Masaya Onosaka, Sayuko Suda, Masane Tsukuyama, and Koichi Yamadera. Yeah, I nailed that.
Win-win.
The unique thing about this movie is that it's actually the character herself that's in the film is somewhat reminiscent of Setsuko Hara, a famed Japanese movie star of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, who actually also withdrew suddenly from public life. Satoshi Kon has recognized the influences in an interview, also citing Hideko Takamine, but insisting that Chiyoko is primarily a universal human character. There's so much within this film, and there's so much unique storytelling to it that you kind of have to like lean more towards the idea of like this has to be based on someone. Like there has to be that influence or that impression from someone that in this storytelling. So, another little tidbit, various photographic effects of aging are used in order to make the Chiyoko's films seem old. They were each filmed separately and passed through different laboratory and telescene processes from the rest of the film. No CG effects were used. So in a lot of the older films that she's a part of, you do see that aging effect. You see that that little bit of tinge, the yellowing, even the just different dynamic of the filmmaking itself. So I thought that was really cool, seeing how this film really travels through so many eras of Chiyoko's life. Commercially, the film performed actually pretty modestly on its U.S. release, earning $37,000, a little over $37,000 during its three-week release. Now, the thing is that doesn't sound like a lot, but it being during 3 weeks of release, it was only shown almost exclusively in New York and L.A. So it didn't receive a huge public advertising campaign from its U.S. partner studio, Go Fish Pictures. So seeing as it literally worked off of word of mouth and just by people mentioning like, oh, hey, this movie's out and you should go see it either in L.A. or New York, it did pretty well. I mean, if you worked 3 weeks and you made $37,000, I'd say you did modestly well.
Yeah.
So like I said, we got a chance to see this film and obviously we had to bring in Amy to kind of help round out kind of some of the things that she saw, because it just so happened that myself and Amy saw the film at the same time. And so there were things that she was noticing that I wasn't noticing, and it really brought another aspect to the conversation. And of course, if there's ever a huge fan of Satoshi Kon here at this table, it is Mr. Spencer Williams.
Yep.
So I'm not going to negate the fact that I'm more than certain he's going to speak more towards the efforts of Satoshi more so than, well, I don't know about Amy, but I know more than I.
No, Spencer is king. Spencer. All hail the Spencer.
Okay.
Yes.
So this movie
is fantastic.
Millennium Actress. Like I said, the first time I had heard about it was probably, like I said, maybe 3-4 years ago. Now, I think we mentioned this movie came out in 2000. What? 2000 or 2001?
2001.
2001. So this movie has been around for 18 years, and oddly enough, this movie came around at around the same time Spirited Away did, didn't it? Because I believe Spirited Away is...
that is a great question. And meanwhile, while everyone is continuing to go about the googly bot, I have a tidbit, because apparently the Wikipedia says that this was the last featured animated film to actually be painted by hand on cells before it moved over to digital paint.
Oh, that's really interesting.
I didn't know that.
Yep. Thanks, Wiki.
Spirited Away was in 2001. So you had both of these films debuting around the same time because Spirited Away, well, it had a March. Well, that's in U.S. They both were released in Japan in 2001. So you had both of these huge films, one by Miyazaki and Studio Ghibli, and the other one by Satoshi Kon. And was it? It wasn't Toei Animation, was it?
Go Fish.
Well, Go Fish was the U.S. partner.
Well, they were also released officially in Japan in 2002, but it debuted at the festival in Japan in 2001.
So that's the release date.
Yeah.
That's technically considered the release date.
That's I say the things that do the things.
She says the things that does the things.
Woo!
So I'm pretty new to a lot of Satoshi Kon's movies, unknowingly. I saw Paprika years ago. I didn't know it was by Satoshi Kon. And seeing as it was the one film that I had seen by him, it kind of just slipped my mind. So the last time when Millennium Actress showed up at the Fathom Events thing and you and I talked about it, you were like, oh yeah, it's by so-and-so, the director. And I was like, who? Because I wasn't familiar with him. Unknowingly, he also is the director and I believe writer too as well to another great film that you really like a lot. And actually, we've talked about it in one of our previous episodes, which was the Father's Day episode this year.
Didn't we?
The role models? The
best parents.
The fatherly figures?
Sure.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, he's being all tight-lipped about this. I like this.
So we talked about Tokyo Godfathers.
Oh,
long story short. Oh my gosh.
Oh, you didn't
Where the heck?
Because I didn't know what he was talking about.
Sorry, he was saying because you talked about Tokyo Godfathers in the Father's Day episode and fathers that we admire, he wanted to like try to lead you that way.
Are you literally doing a recap during the middle of the episode?
I was listening and I was like, what are we talking
about? I'm encouraging everybody to go listen to the Father's Day episode.
Listen to the Father's Day episode is father figures. But here's the thing. I'm literally setting you up to gush about Satoshi Kon. And you're just staring at me with this blank face.
Yeah,
like I just
now I'm like, what did I say?
I'm making a sandwich and then I toss it in the garbage and start making top ramen or something. Like I'm not. I'm trying.
We're making top ramen.
No.
Kind of like garbage top ramen. Based on that.
Okay.
But no. So Satoshi Kon, you're very familiar with Satoshi Kon.
Yes. Okay.
Now I'm only aware of Paprika, Tokyo Godfathers, and now Millennium Actress. But
I thought you said you saw a Paranoia Agent.
Yes, yep. He did Paranoia Agent.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
So this man has like a running theme of like an insane like proposition in the movie, and this one is that the camera crew is literally like going through Chiyoko's memories and following her and like capturing it on film, and that's kind of like what Satoshi Kon does, and he does it great. Is just putting up really just the most insane thing you can think of and making it work most of the time. It's like,
well, that's
Paranoia
comforting.
Agent, like near the end, I'm like, what even happens? And same
that's,
with
that's exactly what you want out of a movie. I mean we've already did that with Tenet, so why not with that?
Yeah.
Which was last week's episode. If you're not aware, take a listen to last week's episode. But, okay, so aside from those four, are there any other things that he's done? Anything else that he's...
Perfect Blue?
Well, yeah. Perfect Blue. That's the one we did not mention. That's what I thought this movie was at first, because I watched Perfect Blue and Millennium Actress the first time around together. So I got them a bit confused, and I was like, when does the singing come in?
One's not about a model.
Yeah.
An idol. An idol. Pardon me.
So that's part of
Perfect Blue.
Yeah.
Perfect Blue.
Yes. Yeah, but his filmography is very short because he died somewhere.
He passed away in 2010.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was pancreatic cancer, if I believe correctly.
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh.
Very sad, because I think he was also beginning work on another film around that time, and it sounded very interesting.
He was 46 at the time of his passing.
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea. Like I said, a lot of my history within this particular filmmaker has been honestly based around Paprika, unknowingly apparently Paranoia Agent, and now this one. That's crazy. So coming into this film, what were some of the things, and I want to pitch this to Spencer, because Spencer's right now the well and actually no, I'll pitch it to Amy first. Because you've apparently seen, what was it, Deep Blue or?
No, I have not seen Perfect Blue.
Oh, Perfect Blue.
Oh, you haven't seen that either.
No, but I'm really good at doing research.
Spence.
No, just double check. I'm literally like writing the surface level of this whole entire filmmaker saga thing. And I'm like, oh yeah, Paranoia Agent. I didn't even know that. Oh yeah. And then it's like.
Verifying. I'm sorry.
I'm just a really good researcher. So I come prepared on occasion.
On occasion.
But no, I haven't seen Perfect Blue. But she does come late.
So.
I haven't seen Perfect Blue or Paprika, but I did see Tokyo Godfathers, which I absolutely adored, and then Millennium Actress. So are you asking about my first impressions?
Well, okay. So then apparently you're not as... So let me check with Spencer first.
Okay.
Spencer.
I'm not cool. I'm here.
You being the person who has the most amount of history within this particular filmmaker in terms of seeing them, seeing his films...
Mm-hmm.
What was one of the things you... Because had you seen Millennium Actress before this?
Yeah.
You had?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What were some of the things... When was the first time you saw Millennium Actress?
Probably like 2008. So this is like... Because I couldn't... I thought this was a different movie. I didn't really remember this movie super well.
So what were you expecting? Like what are some of the expectations for somebody who's a fan of Satoshi Kon? Like what are some of the telltale signs of a Satoshi Kon film that you look forward to seeing? You know? Like trademarks or things that he does? Like... Oh my gosh, like Michael Bay blowing stuff up and recycling things, or Quentin Tarantino on feet, you know, things like that.
Ew.
Okay. Have you not? She hasn't seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I don't want to.
It's gross.
Ew. Feet. I'm the intern. Don't make me.
Dirty feet. That's literally all I remember from that movie, by the way.
No, so I just remember that feet. Part where Leo brought out that flamethrower. Oh, that was funny. No, but like talking about Satoshi Kon. We are all off today. So, no, like I said before, him and his insane setup premise. When you're looking at like Satoshi Kon's movie, like we'll start with Paprika. The fact of them going into like other people's dreams, and that's your setup premise, is just really unique and insane, because this came out before Inception.
I was gonna ask if there was a tie or somebody's like, hey, I got inspiration from Inception. I mean, from Paprika to make Inception.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Inception was like I want to say mid-2000s, and
I Christopher was closer to the end of
2010. Oh,
yeah, I think Paprika was 2006 or 2005, somewhere around there.
I think it's 06. I believe you're correct.
Okay. But yeah, the thing about Paprika, and I'll get to this one in a second, is that while, 2006. You know, Inception had like its layers, and you know, you if you thought it out, it's very understandable. Paprika was willing to be like just insane, because dreams can be very insane sometimes. And like that premise of him willing to go to like insane like proportions to like showcase a story, that's what I really look forward to in his movies. And in Millennium Actress, he does this in the like the fact that people are going through the years and like viewing Chiyoko's memories.
Yeah,
like
actually experiencing them first.
Yeah, because like some of the comments the cameraman says is like oh, you're in this role now, like it doesn't really make sense in reality. Like it's like he's actually there, you know. And like that's a really interesting like position to be in, I think.
Yeah,
but that's kind of what I like about his movies, is that he's willing to like have interesting setups. Because like when I think about just anime movies, no one really does it quite like that. Like everyone has their own style, but no one's done some of the insane things I've seen this man attempt to explain, and he's done just generally a great job in explaining most of his work.
Amy, what were some of the things, you being an avid anime fan and knowing good storytelling, what are some of the things that you were looking forward to when you were, because to be honest, you weren't when we decided to watch it, you weren't really kind of expecting to watch it at that time.
Yeah.
It just so happened
it was
that
a, it was a forced kind of watching. So
it was. So it was very forced.
So when it comes to, because
there were chains and straps onto the couch.
Okay. You know, okay.
Those eye clamps from Clockwork Orange.
Oh my gosh.
I had a pair of those, and then
it was not like that. It okay. Was,
good.
So on occasion, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes older anime, whether it is movie or series, does not age well. So when you're watching it, sometimes you're like, oh, I can't, I don't, oh, my soul, ah. Like,
oh, my soul?
Oh, my soul.
No, sometimes yes. they'll stab you in the soul.
Some of them, yeah. I mean, he's also responsible for JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something, like, I watched a couple episodes of that, and I was like, but when it comes to anime as a whole, with this especially, not expecting it, seeing the trailer, because it was the Phantom Events trailer.
Phantom.
Spookity. It's
spookity, spookity. All right.
So what is it? It's not Phantom. It's Fathom.
Fathom.
Like as the depths, the fathoms. Yeah. Okay. So the Phantom Events trailer, I was not like super excited to see this simply because the way it had, that trailer had been cut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, going online, seeing one of the original trailers, I was like, oh, okay, this looks even better. So sitting down to watch it, the engagement factor was really there because the balance of fantasy and reality was so evenly layered in spaces. I'll definitely try to hold off my comments about my favorite parts because I do have quite a few. Well,
wait till we get there.
I said,
oh my gosh, between
off.
You and Spence, I can't keep
off.
You guys at bay.
Oh my.
I'm like, Spencer's already talking about the movie halfway into his expectations. Like, wait, you're not supposed to be there yet.
I didn't get there yet. I said I was going to wait. I'm trying to be a good intern here. So where's fantasy and reality are being blended really seamlessly.
In the trailer,
where it piques enough of your interest if you're willing to sit down and just go, okay, I'm gonna try something new. Because I'll be very honest, when I originally saw Akira, uh-huh. towards the end with the children,
yeah,
the silence is all I need.
Okay, that's understandable.
So Eddie, how was your expectations of this film? They were spooky.
For me, one of the things that I, when it comes to anime, I'm not going to lie, the majority of my anime film, the majority of my history runs through Studio Ghibli. It's not, or Toei Animation. Like, there's not many anime films that I'm familiar with that I will not, or more than likely can't help but compare it to, you know, a Miyazaki or a Studio Ghibli or a Toei Animation. Toei Animation, for those who don't know, are the ones who did things like the Transformers film, not the Michael Bay, the Transformers 1980.
Yeah, we're all
Transformers,
like,
the movie. You know, the one where Optimus dies in like the first 10 minutes.
He turns gray and just
turns his head. That was the first time people cried in a cartoon movie. Don't knock
the
it.
The first time? That
I mean,
came out when?
85?
Oh, Land Before Time was 91.
Thank
mind.
You. So when this came up in those Fathom events, man, we're doing a lot for Cinemark right now.
They are trying to reopen.
We're gonna tag the heck out of them in this episode. but when I saw the trailer for the Fathom events, to be honest, the trailer, which we actually saw in theaters because mm-hmm. they played it during one of the things for Ghibli Fest,
right.
I believe.
Yeah.
And so we saw it and I'm like, oh my gosh, what is this? Like, there was so much happening, but it looked like it was like moving art. Like every set piece, every image, every scene that they were showing was like something so carefully and artfully done that I was engaged in the trailer alone. Mind you, yes, it was the manic trailer that Amy had probably seen. But separating the music from everything else and just looking at the elements by themselves, like the visuals were stunning enough. And then, oddly enough, Fathom Events had the dubbed version. And then when you go looking for it anywhere else, it's the sub version. And I'm like, oh, okay, what do I want to do? Do I want to read or do I want to listen? You know, it's... and so the expectation for me was, I know I won't be able to help it, and I'm going to probably compare this to a Studio Ghibli film, but I want this to do well on its own, because as much as I love Studio Ghibli, Studio Ghibli aims at the heart of children within everybody, adults and children. Like, it aims to bring you back to that space, that mental mindset of being young at one point in time, or understanding like the whimsy of youth. This looked like it was a film made to really engage the element of people who love anime that are not children. Like the swells of what youth will do at times, and as you get older, and the things that adults understand, like the trappings of love and the movement of how life goes and things like that. And so I was hesitant, to be honest, because I didn't know if I could handle it. Well, because you look at things like, how many Grave of the Fireflies do you see?
Oh my gosh.
There's only one of those.
Never watch that again.
There's only one of those.
That's your one time, never again.
But that's
one was too many.
But what I'm saying is, like, right? Studio Ghibli did one of those out of all the other films they did. What if, in my mind, this was the Grave of the Fireflies for Satoshi Kon? Like, I didn't know. I was hesitant because I know that, like, the one trapping for Studio Ghibli, I didn't know this director. I've never seen a lot of his other films.
My neighbor's the Yamada. Oh wait, we're talking about Satoshi, not the guy that did the Grave of the Fireflies. He's also dead.
Okay.
Just saying. Sorry.
Yeah, I think you just broke Spencer's
house.
Good
job.
My
neighbor the Yamadas, The Tale of Princess Kaguya, but Grave of the Fireflies, we try not to touch that with a very large stick, because that is a scary, sad, just sad piece. Don't go watch it, people. This is your friendly intern warning. Don't go watch it.
I'm going to second that, because, you know, this is during my great Netflix anime watch of, like, the early 2000s or late 2000s or whatever. Yeah.
It's Isao Takahata, by the way.
And he's...
will dead. Not... watch this movie, that movie again, Grave of the Fireflies. Yep. No.
It breaks you.
And so I saw it once. Mind you, this is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I saw it once, and I think I had to watch it in two parts. Like, I don't think I sat through it all in one sitting, which, to be quite honest, that's very understandable. But talking about this film, like, that was an earnest concern of mine. Like, I didn't know if this was that one, if this was the one film... Because you look at everybody, and everybody has that one film that's, like, so unique from the other ones. So my concern was, it wasn't going to be, like, now that I was hyper aware that this is a Satoshi Kon film, this is one of his, I need to be able to recognize, like, a lot of the little things, because I'm watching this, I'm going to review it, blah, 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 that this isn't the one Grave of the Fireflies for Satoshi Kon. So, but jumping into the film... talking about some of the performances and so forth, one of the things that I really... well, even before the performances, one of the things I cannot help but just absolutely gush over, which is something that I mentioned earlier, was the cinematography, like the depth of field in some of these scenes, the way the film just unfolds, like, in terms of the landscape and everything, it is like watching art go by. And knowing how much effort the teams put in behind creating each and every scene, and knowing things like what you had said, Amy.
I pointed out the first time that we meet Chiyoko, she turns into be Chiyoko's rival without even knowing it. The first time we meet her, the way she is profiled with her hat, she essentially is evoking Art Nouveau. So it's the lines, it's the dramatic sweep, it's how she's outlined. And then we see, which is indicative of not just Japanese art as a whole, but art in general in some spaces, silence and the use of silence to drive not just plot, but to drive your eye, to drive your attention, to engage you. So it's the use of silence as a negative space to fill out the picture, which I was just like, yeah, this is awesome.
And mind you, like, This particular film, you can tell that there are things that are done in this film that are in stages, because of the fact that it's such a unique type of storytelling. It's not linear. It jumps back and forth because you go from current day talking about the story at hand. That is, you know, this director, this filmmaker is talking to this famed, you know, recluse actress who is giving an interview who she never gives interviews to. And that is happening simultaneously. They're going back in time and experiencing the actual life of this actress from a young girl all the way through. And it's flopping back and forth. But the scenes that you get, like the scenes of Chiyoko's house are exquisite. Like her home is beautiful. The way every single piece of wood is detailed. And it's not just for like a static piece. When you look at animation, animation is made up of two parts. You have your static and you have your movement pieces. So you have your static image, which is usually in the background, and then you have your moving pieces, which are the ones that are going to animate in front of it. The movement pieces, the dynamic pieces, not the static pieces, are the ones that are like exquisitely drawn, which means that these animators did every single one of these cells with great detail to mimic that, you know, that wood grain or the sheen of the glass in on the windows, or the way the water glistens in the lotus pond. You know, every single aspect of that just began to scream out like, this film is going to become essentially a sensory overload for the eyes right out the get-go. That's what I realized. And it's such a beautiful thing to experience. And one of the great things about it is that it's so different from Studio Ghibli, like completely different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's where with Studio Ghibli, you have sometimes billowy, you have very almost traditional type of shapes and things of that sort. The characters are usually more detailed, but the backdrops are very almost like watercolor-esque sometimes, unless there's movement. But it's very unique. And yet so very different. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And mind you, I don't know if there's really anything to compare it to other than, in terms of art styles, to Spirited Away. Which, it's interesting because Spirited Away is one of the more, like, hyper-specific in terms of the creature designs, character designs, and backdrops. Everything is so elaborate. And take, for instance, the food scene that you get at the very beginning with the parents in Spirited Away. Hmm. And you got all this food and you have all these things that are happening. And it's like, oh my gosh, you can see everything that's piled up on these trays. You can see everything that is detailed in some of these scenes. And you look at this film and you're like that, not even the home scene, like the spaceship scene at the very beginning was like, oh my gosh. This is a spaceship and it looks so great. Like, this is like something I want on my walls kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think, Spence?
So one of the few things that stuck with me, like that I actually remembered when I was remembering the right movie, it was the end scene where she is just running through a whole bunch of different memories all at once.
Yeah.
Because I remember like years ago watching, I was like, this is beautiful, like just watching her like hop from memory to memory and just like the way it all stitches together just so well. Because like it really, like a moving art piece is really the only way I can describe it. And I can't really think of anything that's quite like it either. So it is kind of in this weird indescribable place for me where it's kind of one of the best things I've ever seen, but I don't really have anything else to compare it to, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. Because for us, when it comes to anime, well, before I get into that, what do you think, Amy?
So I was actually literally trying to rack my brain to think of other similar in spaces where there are similar art design that would be comparable in anime film. So the first one that came a little bit to mind in some of the spaces, especially when we're talking about the spaceship, was Ghost in Shell. From the movie, and I was like, okay, a little bit there.
The anime movie.
The movie.
That's
the movie. Yes.
There's two
not,
of them.
Not the live action, the anime movie. The original anime.
I was just
going to
say.
I
forgot about that.
existed for Weren't you there when we reviewed it?
Ghost in the Shell, the live action remake?
Didn't we review
it? We did not do that.
Thank the Lord you didn't. But I'm talking about the anime film.
I would burn that movie.
We did review it, and we had Val on the episode who she burned it a lot more than you probably would have.
She probably watched.
So if you want to listen to
she's old school anime.
She's old, yeah. Val's old school anime. So if you want to listen to that being burned, that's another episode you can listen to.
Oh my gosh, I got to recap.
Stylistically, in little parts, I saw little bits of anime film,
mm-hmm.
Ghost in the Shell, and then I was trying to find other spaces in Ghibli work that had some of the aspects of detail. Which the other one that came to mind was Nausicaä and the Valley of the Wind, which, mind you, the detail work, but it's only specific detail work when you look at the Ohm, which are the big giant beetly buggy thingies, where that's the detail is on that. And same thing you see when we get into Laputa, your guys' favorite, you get little moments like that. But you're talking about Satoshi was one of his favorite films that influenced him was Heidi of the Alps, which was Miyazaki's first. So to think on that he took little bits of different art styles to combine and to make this masterpiece, it is moving art. There is so many principles of traditional Japanese art that are applied in here. There's just art in general. The Spencer talking about the end where she's flashing through, she's on her deathbed, she's flashing through all of those moments to create her final.
By the way,
picture.
This is a spoiler filled movie, so just
she's dying at the end.
You're not aware of it until the end, so now that we're I'll have to put it into the title later.
That'll work.
Spoilers.
Well, if you haven't seen it by now, I mean, it's...
I hadn't seen it until now.
That sounds like a personal problem. So,
by the way, the lesson we reviewed Ghost in the Shell was lesson 57.
Whew,
so that was way back when, but lesson 57, Ghost in the Shell, an empty husk.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I agree with that. So this is, you'll see snatches of other little anime, either films or series that you focus on. You're like, oh yeah, that reminds me of this. And then it immediately draws you back in and redirects you in such a great way where it stands alone on its own as a stunning, it's a work of art. There's nothing else to it. The story itself is absolutely breathtaking. And then when we have great characters like the producer and the cameraman who are essentially us, they are acting in place for us, and then in the first act they're acting as us, and then they transition into almost fanboy spaces.
Well, technically, so
part of the story,
the filmmaker turns into a fanboy.
No,
he's not a journalist,
he's a producer.
Yeah, he's a producer,
but he's not
for a film studio.
It was a journalist. He was supposed to be a journalist. It's an interview.
Okay. All right. You're probably right. I don't know. But it's it's definitely
like, I'm checking.
Good. But it's like one of those things with the films where, with this particular film, where it's so definitive how the art style, it's almost reminiscent because it's done back in 2001. So it's, part of the film is almost reminiscent to what we're used to when it comes to old style anime, things like that, in certain parts.
Cowboy Bebop. That was the other one I was trying to remember.
It actually almost like in the coloring, a little bit of the coloring and the style is almost like, you know, Dragon Ball-esque. Like it had that kind of motif to it. The line work was so unique. There were, like, earlier in the film, you can see like the thicker lines. We actually paused it at one point in time when they do the introduction to Chiyoko's on-screen and off-screen rival. When you're recognizing her, it was very like Jessie from Team Rocket in Pokemon. Like the way her face was structured and everything, a lot of it seemed very familiar. Am I wrong, Spencer?
Spencer has thoughts about Jessie from Team Rocket now.
I didn't think about comparing her to Jessie and Team Rocket. That's all.
I mean, they were both very like deceptive and mischievous. No,
you're right.
But it just, a lot of the parts of the film seem to cater towards the mindset of us traveling through time, not only with this particular character, but even with our own history with anime. And this film seemed more of, yes, it was great to watch this story and the dynamic of Chiyoko and what she went through, which, so essentially the film chronicles the journey and the adventures of this young girl who befriends a rebel during the time of war, helps him escape the soldiers at the time, or the police, who happens to be an artist. And so as payment for him, for her helping him, he tells her that he wants to see her again, in his hometown, where he paints in the middle of this snowscape, like landscape area, where it looks like the snow is endless and you're lost in the wilderness. And before they can like get all the information kind of figured out, like, you know, exchange numbers and all that, he ends up having to leave in a rush and leaves behind this key that he had on a necklace. And so throughout the history of this particular character, you see her pursuing this gentleman, this guy, throughout history, as well as experiencing the ups and downs of film at that time. Now, here's the bigger question, and maybe this is probably the most ridiculous question, but everything that happened prior, well, okay, so everything that happens in the film in terms of like her becoming like, I'm trying to figure out at what point in time, everything was a part of a film,
yeah,
that she had done, right?
Well, mm-hmm. almost, because so we're talking about when she initially meets, and I had to double check it. So when she initially meets the political activist, the painter,
mm-hmm.
We're talking somewhere between 1937 and 1945, which was the, I think it's the Sino-Japanese War. The Chinese call it the War of Resistance against Japanese aggression. But China and Japan were at war during that time. So we've also got the span from 37 to 45, where we also had World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still in that kind of space with her. So we see the aftermath of the bomb in Hiroshima. That part is her hometown, and that is her sweet shop. We see that part because that's where we have, spoiler, the wall, the memento that's left on the wall. So we see that. So you can kind of start building a timeline around that. And then there's a couple of moments where we flash out of the movies to where they're sitting in the living room, or they're sitting in the formal room, and they're having the conversation, and they're both acting out all the different pieces. And then it goes back into the memories. And there's a couple of points where I was a little bit confused, because there was, she's flashing riding a bicycle, and then she's riding it in like traditional Victorian wear, which would make more sense if she was in a film. And then it flashes to there's spaces where there's time interlapping with actual movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that you know that they're actual like reality memories, if we don't call it movie memories versus reality memories, where they're reality memories, are spaces where...
You mean real memories?
not
film, but real memories.
Well, I mean, the film ones are real memories.
Okay,
okay, too.
let's stack this real fast so that I can explain for you, Eduardito. We're going back through her memories and measuring her legacy through film.
Yeah.
But not entirely through film.
And that's what I was wondering.
We're connecting moments of her real memories, so her reality, with her film memory, mm-hmm. that reality. So you're blending. It's daisy chaining.
The story blends both reality and film to make this
reality
fantastical.
And film fantasy.
Yeah.
Da da da. I said that. Shazam.
And interestingly enough, the kind of structure you're talking about, actually, so every single instance of some of the bigger instances of Chiyoko's life are actually tied to earthquakes, which it's established early on that earthquakes are a big part of the story that you're about to watch, because she was born during the Great Kanto Earthquake, so her birth date is September 1st, 1923. She gave up her career after another great earthquake, perhaps based on the Niigata earthquake, which occurred on June 16th of 1964. And then Chiyoko dies during another earthquake, which was the Western Honshu earthquake, which occurred on October 6, 2000. So you have a time frame already established within her career. So it's actually, it's pretty interesting that those beats give us a frame of reference to work around, which it sounds like you did, Amy.
Yeah.
Kudos.
Woo, go me.
I'll give you a treat for being a good intern.
I get snacks. Sweet.
But that's one of the unique things about this film, is that it carries those unique beats. And that's kind of like why I wanted to also know about the aspect of how the storytelling moved forward, because there are parts of it where, honestly, within this story, you are just engaged, but you don't know if it's like, okay, you're engaged and you're kind of losing track of the timing of the area, or the timing of the situation, or even the realm of like what's happening in the mindset of surrounding that particular situation. Obviously, it seems like it's a movie, but then is it an actual movie, or is it actually something that is happening in her real life? And so that's where kind of just making those two broad assumptions.
No, I had a great example of
no,
that.
No, go ahead. I'm listening.
So when Chiyoko first loses the key, where it's lost and she has everybody searching for the key, and it comes out later that somebody had stolen the key, all in the ploy for this one director to marry her.
Directors.
It starts out where she is sitting across from her mother, and she's having a conversation about why she's still not married.
Yeah, that's right.
And then they flash, and this was one of the things that you pointed out, Eddie, mm-hmm. was that the reflection in the glass, you see her, and once her head shifts down, it swaps to being on the film set, and it's her rival sitting in the position of as the mother,
mm-hmm.
and she's having a conversation, and then they cut, and suddenly the key is missing. So yeah. That's the one of the times where the transition from reality, real memory, I don't know, her reality memories to film memory are so seamlessly like integrated that if you are not literally paying attention, you wouldn't know. Like, you would be like, oh, it's all the same thing.
Yeah, no, and that's kind of where I was kind of, that's where I was kind of stuck at in trying to recognize how much were they pushing on the fantastical sense, the filmmaking sense, whereas actually telling, and you know what, that's honestly the good mark of a great, you know, a great form of storytelling, to be honest. If you can't tell the difference, just like for a great example, things like Big Fish, Tim Burton's Big Fish. That movie is a great example of storytelling within storytelling that blurs the line of truth versus reality. And you don't know what is truth or reality until the end of the film. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is great. And you get this like unique payoff. And in some of those instances, sometimes not getting the payoff is just as rewarding. Not knowing like the, okay, well, let me pull the curtain behind this, and this is what happens. Like, for instance, this particular film doesn't easily pull that curtain back. And that's okay, because it's not about recognizing like where the story's hard lines fall in. It's about recognizing where the viewer, the person who is watching the film, and even like you said, as a audience member carrying that perspective with the reporter, or actually, to be honest, we play the role of the cameraman. Like, we're more in that role, because he's like, what is happening? Like, why are we like, now we're stalkers. We can't tell the difference because of everything that is happening, and seeing how much of it is engaging with the world around them currently. I mean, there's a couple of scenes where the reporter, who has this infatuation with this actress, is portraying certain roles in some of the films that she's recounting in like great detail as if he was the one who was in the film, but because he loves it so much, he is the one who's in it. But then you're like, wait, but so then if he was in it, how is he impacting the story? And is this story a part of the film, or is this a part of her life? And what's happening? Like, it creates this blurred line from reality to the fantasy. And that's okay, because we as viewers, we as the audience, we're engaged either way. We're watching the film. We are totally sucked in. And to be honest, at those different points in time, I didn't care if I knew where the difference was, where the difference was showing what was reality and what was fantasy. You know, it was kind of like the alternate ending of Big Fish. I don't know if you guys had ever seen the special features on Big Fish. Mm-hmm. Did you guys see the ending of Big Fish?
Mm-hmm.
How does it end?
He turns into a fish.
Okay, well, that's...
Spoiler.
No, so at the end of...
His father turns into a fish, well, and everybody comes to see him off.
So what happens is the father... Have you seen Big Fish?
No.
Okay.
Oh, so, sorry, buddy.
Spoiler.
Yeah. The dad spoilers turns, for a whole bunch of movies.
Yeah, today.
It's
is
really
spoiler
nice,
fest.
Actually. If it's you want to watch it, well, at the end, he turns into a fish.
So the thing is, you know the father's dying. From the very beginning, the father's dying.
In the hospital dying.
No, he's at home dying. He's at home.
They have to take him home from the hospital first.
He's dying.
Yes.
And so the son, who is somebody who grew up with his father telling all these kinds of stories when he was younger and kind of grew out of it, has to come back home to help kind of, you know, be there, you know, for everybody. And so while he's there, like, his dad is telling him, he's recounting all the stories that his dad had told him about his life. And they're all fantastical stories with, like, mermaids and witches and, you know, things like that.
The circus
and working for Danny DeVito. Like, all these things.
Oh, it is. It's working for Danny DeVito.
But all these elements are things that he experienced. And so the son is like, you know, why can't I get a straight answer from you? It seems like you're always telling me stories, blah, blah, blah. So it's essentially about a father-son rekindling a relationship so that they could have that one final set of resolutions before he passes on. So as the dad passes, the dad's like, tell me, you know, how do I go? Like, what's the next part of my story? And so the son is the one who comes up with that, which it's great because the son is like, you know, well, this is what happens. And in the son's story, he takes his father, carries him to the water. Then when he puts him into the water, his father turns into a big fish and swims away. But there's an alternate ending similar to Secondhand Lions, where all the people who he had experienced in his life show up to the funeral. And they actually introduce themselves to the son and the family. Oh. Danny DeVito shows up. The tall man that he helps shows up. They all show up, and it creates that definitive line, like, oh my gosh, he was telling the truth. But in the original ending, it's a little bit more blurred. You're like, okay, so you don't know what's true and what's not.
It's what you choose to believe.
It's what you choose to believe. And in this particular frame of mind, with this film, all the way to the end, the focus was not on, for the audience, not to focus on which parts were from her personal life and which ones were from the films, but to recognize what was the driving force behind every act she ever did.
Mm-hmm.
And what did it get her? Because it, you come to find out that it's not in the mindset of wanting to be the best actress or wanting to actually find this person. It was in the focus of the pursuit of this person, just searching, not actually finding, but searching, because that's what she says at the very end of the film. She found that she wasn't in love with the guy, but the pursuit of him. And it was the chase. It was the driving towards. It was the never obtaining, but coming to, the journey, if you will. And Amy's giving these raised eyebrows because she doesn't agree.
I don't, but I want to hear Spencer's. No, no. I want to hear Spencer's opinion first.
Oh, well, no, I kind of am with Eddie with this, because, like, you know, like, right up until that line, it does seem like, you know, she's doing it because she loves him for some reason, which is not really something I quite get, like, as a concept, because, like, what, she had, like, a one-day interaction with this person?
Have you not seen every Disney movie? I'm just kidding.
Well,
That was bad.
So bad.
You cannot marry a man you just met.
But, Daddy, I love him.
Do you? Do no. you know what you're doing with your life? Every Disney
sandwiches.
Princess almost.
Thank you. Thank you. Them calling that out. You've known him for a day, but I love him. No. No, you don't. Thank you, Elsa. We'll appreciate you forever.
I know,
that
was like
that.
The best line. But yeah, no. I didn't really get her drive, like why she was so persistent mm-hmm. after this man from like barely an interaction. Like, you know, like even if you kind of like someone, you're not going to base what you do for the next 40 years off that.
Not even 40.
It was about 40.
No, well, yeah, 1923, 10 years after that, so 1933, 1934.
Ish, it's
all the way to
there.
2000.
Well, she'd have to be, it'd have to be 37, so she'd be in 16 or so.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's
well,
a lot.
Regardless, it's way too much.
It's most of her life.
Yeah, so, like, I feel like, you know, the pursuit really makes a lot more sense if she's just like, you know, that's what she's actually into, is just pursuing after this guy versus like, you know, actually in love. But now I'm curious about what you think.
Okay, so
here we go.
Strap in.
Okay,
strap right. in.
I
oh my gosh.
What? Spaceships.
Kind of experience.
Spaceships,
are you gonna...
fella.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
goodness.
I don't know what she's talking about.
So
she's an intern.
So true. Very true. Very, very true. So in traditional Japanese culture, and seen in some Japanese shows, i.e. I can bring up The Midnight Diner, we see the impact of a quote-unquote first love, which that storyline runs through most anime. So it was, oh, it was my first love, and they hold this candle for the first person they had a crush on, even if they're 40, 50, whatever. Okay, we've got that set up, right?
You're not going to base your entire premise on Midnight Diner, are you?
No, shush.
I'm just saying. I just realized. I'm like, oh my gosh, if you're going to base it on a series from 2000. Okay, go ahead.
I'm using that as the base level for the first love, like, obsession.
This is a multi-tiered explanation, apparently. That's the first level.
So also the abruptness in which he is ripped from her life creates intrigue. Now, as a person who, when she takes on the job of going to Manchuria or Manchua, it's another part of that same war. Going there, she's like, oh, I want to do my job, blah, 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 but I really want to return the key. So she has this entire concept of wanting to at least see him having the resolution. It's not like, oh, googly eyes, hearts, yay. So I understood that. But then it becomes... I think it's not until she realizes when she gets off the train, she has gone to Hokkaido to find him. And in the snowstorm, she is literally going and going, and she gets there and she realizes he's not there anymore. That he is dead, that she gets to that realization that he's dead. The producer says that she... After Hokkaido, she came back and she kept filming like there was nothing wrong. And then in the earthquake in the big spaceship movie, which was her last one, suddenly she stops entirely. That's where she goes and she's recluse. I think that in her final spaceship movie, that it was the moment of her realization that it was the love of the pursuit and not the affection he has, the phantom affection she had for him. Now, mind you, at Hokkaido, was she still holding out some type of a candle to his memory? Like, did she infatuation feel for him? Heck yes. Like, that pursuit is what continued to drive her forward. But it still was, yes, I said the word pursuit. Her infatuation continued to drive her forward, but I don't think until her final movie did she really come clearly to a point that she understood that the pursuit is what made her happiest versus the actual obtainment of him.
Which is what I said. You just took a longer route just to get back to home. It's okay. It happens.
I don't get snacks now, do I, Spencer?
No snacks. and this is part of the story where a lot of people, a lot of filmmakers, they try to take the easy way out and they make the the situation occur at the end where like the love scene is, you know, the coming together at the end, like, you know, even in death, like, oh, we'll be together in death, like a Romeo and Juliet kind of mindset or whatever. However, even as this woman was passing, it was never, it's weird. And I don't mean this to be respectful of the film, but I kind of gravitate back to the quote from, the Joker in the Dark Knight, where he goes, he's like a dog chasing cars. He wouldn't know what to do if he could catch up to one. This is one of those things where it's like the pursuit of something gave her more life or gave her more fervor and purpose rather than the actual obtainment of it. Because it was a lot of those decisions that she made based on it that gave her the life she had. And the pursuits and the situations that she ended up having, which oddly enough influenced a lot of the films that she did and created those blurred lines within her life of what was fantasy and what was reality. I do have to say one of the best things about this film was the somewhat twist towards the tail end when you learn that the reporter slash post, you know, old, the filmmaker, whatever he was, the producer, already knew that the man had passed almost, what was it, 20 years prior, 30 years prior. He knew of it and has been holding on to that for so long. That kind of little twist there at the end, it was like, it very much held the story element of like, this film was meant to give you that journey, and for you, at least in some element, to have that resolution, as if not the character itself, as the audience, as the cameraman, knowing, oh my gosh, so he's not here anymore, and oh my gosh, she's passing away, and she was given the key, and so she can, you know. There's a lot of elements of this film that just culminate into this one beautiful crescendo of a finale as the film ends, and it really does like tug at your heart as one of those movies that definitely steps away from the Studio Ghibli elements and moves into the realm of like, oh my gosh, this could be me in like 30 years, or this could be anybody. This is a definite, like, I have more of an affinity to possibly end like Chiyoko's life as opposed to like the little girl from Spirited Away or the other little girls from the little kids from Laputa, or like I have more of a connection to actually living life like this person than that, and it creates that human connection. It creates that emotional touch point for people who watch it, because it's like we're three grown adults in this room. I'm pretty sure at some point in time throughout that film we connected to the character in that film in her pursuit of something that makes her life meaningful. And I think it's the understanding that this film recognizes that we have to never stop finding what makes life so meaningful, because the moment we stop, life then becomes meaningless, I guess, so to speak. And you become a recluse of yourself. You step away in the efforts of knowing what it is that makes you happy and driving for it. Even if you never obtain it, that let alone has the ability to possibly make you happy. You know? I don't know. That was like the wrapped up mindset that I had after like watching the film and honestly having to give myself like at least 12 hours to really process everything I saw. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Spence?
No, it's just, you know, I think I really like your takeaway on that, because sometimes I have a tendency of getting stuck up on things in movies, like, why is she preserving this guy? Like, even when, like, the movie explains it, like,
my brain gets stuck. Especially when the movie explains it.
Sometimes I'm like, She shouldn't have been doing that for 40 years. That's where I get stuck on. So, like, no, I just really appreciate that explanation. I think that makes a lot more sense.
What about you, Amy? What are your thoughts, the final thoughts on this film?
Besides that, I liked it.
Well, we'll go over whether we liked it or not in the
final thought. I liked it. No, I think your takeaway was probably the one that is most consistent with Satoshi recognizing that his audience is not children, are not children.
Yeah.
That the running lines that I was watching wasn't just recounting every deed that she did. It was a running pursuit. It was a legacy. It was something that I was thinking at the end, was that of all of the things she could have pursued, of all of the careers, of all of the jobs she could have taken on, her family owned a sweet shop, and she chose to go into film. Where else can you be preserved for a lifetime to always look the same? And if she was giving every opportunity for him to come find her, I had this kind of weird backwards notion of, she knows that he's out there somewhere, and if she keeps making movies, he'll come, he'll find her, and she'll look, he'll be able to kind of follow and find her one day. That was my brain. And then coming to that space of, she accepts and acknowledges that he's gone, and why is she going to make anything anymore? Like, almost like all I'm thinking is the beacons are lit. Oh my gosh.
Gundor calls for aid.
Gondor is going to call for aid. But leaving those trail markers so that somebody could find her one day towards the end. And coming to the realization on her last film that he's gone, that the pursuit, that it's time to step back, that it's time to understand that your purpose is done. What do you live for? It's one of those things that a lot of people tell you, especially in your old age, if you don't have a purpose, you're going to die a lot quicker just because you're there, which I don't know if we saw that sped up at the end of her life. She was still beautiful. She moved wonderfully, but she was dying and she knew it. And that final recount where she's like, I think me just pursuing him was what I loved about it most, was one of those things that you kind of have to wonder if she had continued to make movies, even though he wasn't there, would she have lived past 70? But that's just me. I think a lot about weird things.
Well, and you have to consider as well within that dynamic, what part of her kind of went, and mind you, this is also taken from another bit of inspiration from other pieces of work, but like, for instance, you look at The Dark Knight Returns, and you look at that graphic novel, and which is also an animated film, and you look at somebody like the Joker, who is almost like in this catatonic state within Arkham Asylum, and he literally has, and he says that, you know, it's almost like he had nothing to live for until the Batman came back into his life. And it wasn't so much Batman that revitalized him, it was the pursuit to be an opposite for Batman. It was the drive to create balance, if you will, within the dynamic of powers within Gotham. You have this incredible powerhouse in Batman. The only equal to the extreme logical Batman is the extreme illogical Joker. And that's what gave him purpose. In that same mindset, I think her life was just put on hold, and she just kind of was in like an idle state until the producer brought back the necklace, the key, and it, like she says, it rekindled what she remembered. And in those few moments, in that day that she got to recount all those things, she got to relive those great moments and essentially come back to a place where she felt more alive than she had as of late. So, why do you say that?
No, I just felt like it was necessary because somebody listening to us would be like, "Aw, dang, shoo."
Well, okay.
Spence is like, hee-hee.
So, as we wrap this up, let's go ahead and go around the table. And I want to go ahead and start with Amy, because I want to end with Spencer.
Okay.
Actually, I'll start with me, because I'm the least experienced Satoshi Kon fan here. And we'll go. This is a credit to you. Don't give me the look, the furrowed eyebrows, and the grr.
I'm not grrring. Uh-huh, I'm whatever. Confused.
You're confused. So I'll go first. The film was great. I absolutely adored the filmmaking. I absolutely adored everything about the movie and how it showed the story of this particular person and her life and how everything just mattered to her in the pursuit of this particular individual. So the film passes for me, and in terms of monocles, I'm honestly going to probably give this a 5 out of 5. I think it's kind of that simple for me. There's really not much, to say other than this was an exquisite film and it was made for me now, as opposed to made for me when I would have probably seen it when it came out back in 2001. Mm-hmm. So this movie is perfect for me now. And I have to appreciate that in my life, in where I'm at now and everything. This is a great film, and I know I'll probably be revisiting it and buying the revised version of it, all that other stuff that Spencer talks about. So what about you, Amy? How does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Super passes for me.
Super passes.
Well, I already said I liked it like way prior, so it passes. What?
Hmm? I said way prior.
Okay.
Because it just seemed like a very interesting...
I was waiting for you to say Richard Pryor, but yeah, okay. So, it passes for me. It really... The way that you actually just said that it was made for you now, that you better understand it now, that you more appreciate it now, is very telling of us as adults,
mm-hmm.
versus just as the art that each of these directors has been giving us. So, for me, I definitely give it... I can give it a 5. No problem. Will I be revisiting it anytime soon? I'll probably go Tokyo Godfather just for my heart. But yeah, it's wonderful. I recommend it. It is made for adults with the remembrance of legacy in, you know, your legacy and how you matter to yourself in mind. Spencer, help.
What about you, Spence?
This movie passes for me. So the first time I saw this movie, I was probably around 18, and I thought this woman was stupid because she was just carrying this candle for a guy, and I didn't get it. Like, I thought it was like an okay film, but you know, I didn't get it. I'm now much older than that, and this movie kind of hits differently. When you are over 30,
My God, we're old.
You're only old when you feel it. Right now, it's just we're aged like a fine bottle of wine.
Yeah, let's go with that for right now.
Yes,
and then
for now.
And then it sours and turns to vinegar, and then you get...
Hey, he's talking about how it hits differently. Let the man finish. I want to hear this.
No, this movie, like, hits a lot differently.
I'm sorry, it sounded like I hate to interrupt, but it sounded like you were talking about drugs. Like, this man's talking about how it hit differently. Like, all right, we're doing a little bit of a CBD sampling here.
Oh, my goodness. Spencer, help.
Philosophers does not promote drug use in any way.
It's legal. Go ahead.
Oh, my gosh.
This movie is not for kids or even maybe teens who are not quite emotionally there yet. This one kind of just like took me, like, because like before I started watching this movie, I was going to be like, this is probably my least favorite Satoshi Kon movie. Still not my most favorite, but it did move up quite a bit. So I'm just really impressed with this movie. You know, I have to give it a 5.2 because, like, it's just really impressive how much there is layered in here,
mm-hmm.
just overall.
Yeah.
And for him to have done, like, the creative writing style of just going into memories, I don't know if anyone could have done it as well as he did. Yeah.
It's a great point. And this was a great movie. And like we said, this was one of those movies where If you're not familiar with it, check it out. It's on Amazon. Well, you got to rent it. You can rent it on Amazon, on any pretty much any video streaming platform.
And if you don't want to pay any money to see it and you don't mind reading, it is available on Pluto TV for free.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Pluto. And I paid for it.
Well, no, you wouldn't watch it because there was limited ads.
Oh, no. I wouldn't.
Man, were they pushing good RX? It was ridiculous.
It does work, though. We'll have that talk.
Oh, my gosh. You said we're not old. Stop.
I have asthma. That doesn't make me old. That just makes me weird.
Who wants some Werther's?
Me. Wait.
You're not helping your cause.
But I liked them before I got over 30.
Well, I'm getting them from my grandmother.
Oh, my gosh. Mine, you guys coffee. Are not helping.
We liked this movie.
Well, apparently.
We are celebrating our legacy and our don't be ageist.
Don't be ageist? I'm not being anything. I'm trying to close a podcast.
Are you? Is that it for us?
But that wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Yeah, this film was really great. And if you do want a chance to check it out on Pluto. Rent it. I'm pretty sure they're going to come out with a HD remastered version.
Well, they did a redubbing of it last year.
Watch oh, that's
it
in, right.
Watch it subtitled first, though. I appreciate the wonderful voice that is the very original true. Japanese actors and actresses first, please.
Yeah, very true, very true. Amy.
Yep.
Where can people find you at on the socials and all the places?
On the socials, as prior stated, I am iJaneURobot. Wow. iJaneURobot on the various social media platforms. You can also find me and my capeless brethren at thecapelesscrusaders.com. Your hub, your home away from home for all things comic book related and crusaderish. Our last episode was actually on the Back to the Future comic books because we are celebrating our nerd on brethren and sisterin, because hey Caitlin, their 30-year anniversary, and they did Back to the Future part 1, 2, and 3. So yeah, you can definitely check that out on any place that you can find your podcast services. Probably not like you guys on Pandora.
That's true. Yeah, well, if you get a chance. Well, first off, thank you, Amy, for coming on and being a part of the show.
I'll remember coffee next time, I promise. Please don't hurt me.
Yeah, come on. Interns? Seriously. Also, like Amy said, you can catch The Filmlosophers on all streaming platforms. Apple, iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Stitcher, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, all of them places. You can also check us out on the website. We are at filmlosophers.com. All 200-plus episodes. We're at 230-something. That's all I know. So we're up there in the numbers. So you can check us out on all of our episodes there as well. You can catch us on socials. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. So check us out there. We'd love to hear from you. As I said, this was a great episode. So we can't wait to check up and follow up with this episode with probably another great anime, because to be honest, I'm kind of on a little bit of a what you call it, a Satoshi Kon kick, so we might have to do something else really great. We might have to do Tokyo Godfathers. I don't know.
Well, he still hasn't seen The Boy and the Beast either.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, golly gosh.
It's sadder. I'm telling you offline.
We're going to get offline. Oh my gosh. We got some anime talkies.
Okay, those are some animal anime talkies. Whatever. You know what? It's late. We had a great conversation. I'm going to leave it at that. So, from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm intern Amy.
Class dismissed.